experience in humanitarian relief and assistance with Cambodian refugees, with survivors of the tsunami in South Asia, specifically in Thailand in 2004, to victims of the earthquake in Peru a number of years ago, to people in East Timor and Tibet. And he's going to be speaking about humanitarian assistance in Myanmar. Dr. Susat, when he's not involved in humanitarian assistance, is an urgent care physician here in California, and he's also worked in Hawaii. Dr. Susat.
I thank you, Barry, and I'm happy to be here. Let's see. Let's move right into it here. Cyclone Nargis slammed into Myanmar, formerly Burma, on the 2nd of May of this year. And for a couple of days, it actually traveled through Burma and left at least 200,000 people dead. Some estimates are that there may be over a million people died. It's hard to know because of the conditions the people were living. It's sort of like the tsunami, that a lot of the dead were in makeshift houses on the very low-lying areas and in very sort of a borderline state anyway. In the aftermath, a lot of people died. For example, this five-year-old boy who was very malnourished following the tsunami, the cyclone. Now, this is a wordy slide, but the joint NGOs, when people were finally allowed into the country, made an assessment here, and all of these words go to say that, you know, things were an unprecedented mess in the area, with many of the many houses destroyed, rice crop that had headed toward harvesting was destroyed. Many of the domestic animals were dead in the aftermath. Many of the fishing boats, houses, the schools. So it was a disaster of unprecedented magnitude, and it was made worse by the fact that the military junta that has ruled Burma for the last 20 years was actively preventing foreign relief workers from coming in. There were military ships from various nations, including the United States, hovering offshore ready to deliver aid, and these were barred. No visas were being issued for foreign workers. We were among the first. We were the first foreign medical people in the region, and it took us 2 months to get in. So this is the Aloha Medical Mission, which for several years has been, well, for the last 25 years has been sending out medical teams to various parts of Asia. So you can see the vulnerability of many people that were living in the Delta. And we arrived in Rangoon, Yangon, and our team was then bused 5 hours into the Delta, and then some of us went further down by boat another 5 hours. And along the low-lying islands there in the Delta, we saw a lot of houses that were, you know, had been destroyed and were being makeshift rebuilt with plastic, trees blown over. People searching through the rubble still for bodies and whatever else they could find on the banks of the river. The tidal surge in this, sort of like New Orleans, was a couple of meters high, and it lasted all night. And many of the dead were women and children who couldn't swim. Like the tsunami, I mean, the people who survived were basically well, except for the mental health effects. In fact, that slide of the depression where you saw malnutrition and mental health problems and homelessness, deja vu all over again. Arriving in the town of Kodankani, which was out in the Irrawaddy Delta, which was the nearest place that had a hospital, and we worked there with the local health staff. The survivors of the cyclone, some of them were put into temporary camps and shelters. And the Burmese government, saying that they didn't want people to become dependent, they actually evacuated. They moved people out of the shelters pretty quickly without much to go home to, saying that they could fish and eat frogs and survive as they always had. So we based ourselves in Kodankani Hospital, and what we saw were people who, everybody lost somebody, and some people had lost 5, 10, in one case 30 family members. And people came in, they hadn't slept since the tsunami, because every time the wind blew or the rain fell, it brought back, you know, their terrors. And just continually we saw patients who had lost everybody. A surviving twin. And this was a 5-year-old boy with pneumonia who was very malnourished and suffered from exposure after the tsunami, and he died a couple of hours after this photo was taken. A baby with a bit diarrhea. We saw infections. This was a woman with a new unilateral exophthalmos, which was probably a tumor. And even in the best of times, where does somebody like this go? Her nephew needed cardiac surgery. Several other kids we saw. And in these cases, people like this were sent up to Rangoon, up to the capital, for evaluation. And luckily we had a little budget that could support further evaluation. From Kodankani, some of us went by boat for a day to a town called Eya, where all of the houses on the beach and the coconut trees were blown over. This beach was full of houses before. And it was a big tree that blew over and smashed that house behind and killed 5 people. But the whole beach, according to some of the survivors, was littered with bodies. I mean, it was the tidal line was just solid bodies that washed in from the other islands. Many of the kids were orphaned, and many people lost children. Very reminiscent of the tsunami, which I was lucky enough to have survived. I'm swimming in Thailand and went off to Sri Lanka several times after that to work, including with Patch Adams and 30 Clowns 3 months after the tsunami. That was kind of fun, giving people a reason to smile after losing everybody. So our medical team, we had to bring our own food for the weeks that we were there, and slept in one room in a local house. We were sponsored by a senior monk, the Sayadaw Sitagu, who is very well respected and is sort of above the government. He has very high placed followers. He has monasteries in the United States. And so under his auspices, since the Aloha Medical Mission had been several times before, we were able to get our visa before other people. I also went representing a group called Airline Ambassadors International, which is mostly airline employees delivering aid to orphanages and schools. And one thing that we're going to be doing on an ongoing basis is helping to rebuild some of the hundreds of schools which were destroyed. Groups like Mercy Corps paid people for work, which is like organizing the rubble into roads and foundations for schools, and just giving people income and sort of a motivation to kind of get their lives together after the disaster. These were boats provided by the Myanmar government. They said, you know, we don't want foreign relief workers, but we're happy to take your money and we'll figure out where it needs to go best. There were new homes which were provided by the government for certain members of the population. We were able to provide some portable water filtration devices for different communities and schools. So, even five months now after the disaster, what people remember is that the government was recalcitrant in allowing aid in, and but what really happened in addition to this was that aid agencies, through all this hammering, were able to gain in unprecedented levels of access and mobility, not only in the Delta but in other areas of Burma. And the recommendations from people who've spent many years in development and in Asia are that the European and international community needs to continue to vigorously support livelihood recovery operations, capacity building that strengthen local Burmese organizations. I mean, the whole time we're there, we were had to be very careful about who we would be working with that would be in trouble because of the government spies. It was obvious that regime change is necessary there, as it is in several other nations in which we live. The spirit of 1848, which I learned about yesterday, the last words here are that preserving health and preventing disease requires full and unlimited democracy and radical measures rather than mere palliatives. And that's what we saw most of all, is that in a disaster of this magnitude, when you've got a government that's actually working against the interests of the people, it makes it impossible to really be effective. And in terms of the ongoing effects of this, the mental health, we had a specialist with us, Dr. David Ratneval, who we've worked with for many years in terms of mental health for refugees and relief workers and survivors of disasters. And that was his assessment, that without the government will there, it's going to be difficult to really implement programs. But working through the temples, through the head monk, through the clinics and the schools, that maybe there's a chance to provide some care here. So questions?
Thank you very much, Dr. Sousa. We have time for at least one question. Are there questions or comments? Yes, please come over to the microphone if you would. We are recording the session. These sessions, the recordings, and also the slides will be available on the APHA website, just to let you see.
I just wondered if you have a current update on the bridges that were hardest hit and what is the current summary building happening.
Well, I'm in touch with several organizations, Mercy Corps and then the Sayadaws groups. Money is trickling in, especially through the head monk, and schools are being rebuilt. I check online now and then also to see what's happening. It was poor before, it's worse off now, and it's struggling. Many organizations that were working in the country have, you know, redoubled their efforts to focus more in the Delta, and some new organizations have actually been allowed in now to work. So.
Again, thank you very much.